Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast, where we talk and share our stories of how to create wealth through passive investing. And on our shows, we bring on active investors as well as those who invested passively to share their thoughts, ideas, and lessons learned throughout the investing world and alternative investments outside of the stock market. Today, I have a special guest from Realm Investors. I got Justin Moy. Justin, how are you today?
Chris, man, I'm doing fantastic. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm excited to kick this off.
Yeah, we were just actually pre-recording, you know, just talking about our locations and the podcasting industry. So it was a good call. But as we roll into the show, Justin, with our investors, why don't you give us a little background of kind of what you got going on today and a little history of how you got into real estate to get to the point of where you're at today?
Yeah. So real estate has been really the pillar of my professional career. When I was 17 years old, I got my first office job as a commercial real estate company. And I hated what I was doing. I mean, I was an intern. I was doing a lot of data entry. I was putting together marketing packages. I was really assisting the brokers with whatever they needed. But I would see the broker and it was so cool what they were doing. They were closing big deals. They were celebrating a lot. They were in the office, out the office, kind of going back and forth. And I really kind of caught that bug. I always knew from my retail jobs that I was pretty good at sales. I was always the number one salesperson in the country for these big chains that I would work at. And so when I turned 18, I decided, okay, I want to get into real estate sales. At that time, I was living in the Bay Area of California. So the home prices, seven figures, almost everything. I was an 18-year-old kid and my average home sale was $2.2 million. So
intimidating, by the way.
You know, it was a little bit, but I was born and raised there. That's just what I thought houses costed. I didn't know until a little bit later that you could go to Detroit and buy a home for 40 grand. It wasn't even an option in my time. So I kickstarted that. And what I realized throughout that journey was, of course, I was making a lot of money, but I was transactionally rich and I wasn't really wealthy. And at a young age, you don't really understand the differences between those two, but I was working so much, so many hours. I was so stressed out. I realized that I was sacrificing my personal relationships, my physical health, my mental health, and everything was getting put on the back burner. So I decided, okay, I have to do something else. I can't just get one check and go anymore. I have to get residuals. So that's what brought me into looking to be an owner. Now, in the Bay Area, at least when you crunch the numbers on single family homes, it's not a great story in terms of cash flow. You kind of have this enormous runway. You have to accumulate tons and tons of homes to get something meaningful. So I got a little discouraged there. Ended up moving around the country, finished up college in Arizona, moved to Arizona. Now I'm in Kansas City and really dove into multifamily about 4 or 5 years ago. So got into the syndication space, was syndicating multifamily. And of course, you've known the past couple of years have been hot, hot, hot years for multifamily. So jumped into a hot market. And today, while we still look at multifamily, we do more of a fund of funds model. And we've pivoted quite a bit to short-term rentals. And those have been absolutely crushing it for us. So that's really been our main focus for the year. But we are still, you know, in the residential space. I do still believe in multifamily. I think it'll be maybe another year or 2 years until cap rates are what we feel they should be for the product we're looking at. But for now, you know, we're doing short-term rentals and those are absolutely crushing it. I mean, double-digit cash flows, but only 75% of those properties in the fund stabilize. I mean, they're crushing it there. So we're going to focus there for probably the rest of the year while we kind of wait for multifamily, what I think will normalize in the next couple of years.
Two things that popped in my head when you were telling a little bit of a story, when you started out basically doing the paperwork and getting all the paper cuts and all of that work. Now, it reminds me of the movie, The Karate Kid, where, you know, the wax on, wax off or paint the fence. And it's interesting because everyone jokes about that within the movie, but it's actually the real life story of most people. You usually do not start at the top. Yeah. And I think a lot of people, when they want to get involved, especially in real estate, and they don't have that experience, like, oh, I want to go do this. But when you start at the bottom and work for people who have already worked their way there, personally, yeah. And this is just my personal opinion, I think people advance quicker by having that person there because it acts as your mentor and you're getting paid. I know people will go out and pay money for a mentor to learn things, but if you went out, got a W-2 job and working for people much higher, and again, every person is different, I think that is a valid way to kind of grow and get educated that I think too many people undersell.
Yeah, I think that's something that people need to consider, especially when they're starting out in anything, is yes, the money was good in that industry, but I got to learn from people who were doing it for 20, 30, 40 years. And that was invaluable. And yes, while I do believe in paid mentorships and paid coaching programs, I mean, I paid six figures in coaching and education myself for multifamily and for investing. That's an invaluable way to learn. And like you said, get paid as well, because you're adding value to them and then they're going to pay you. And then the real payment of you comes from the education that you have while you're there. That's really what's going to set you up in the future.
And one last thing I'll just mention on the education piece, and of course we'll move on, is the timing of when you get educated, I think, is important. Because I think getting educated or paying significant funds up front when you have zero experience versus learning, taking a year to really educate yourself on things, I think the amount you'll learn during that time will be very different, because when you start out, you don't know what you don't know. And, oh, I picked up this. Is that the important tidbit that you were supposed to pick up and you miss these other four?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like you said, it's that you're unaware consciously of what you're looking at, what your goals are. And that's when you align yourself with people who have been there, done that, you pick up on these things a lot quicker, whether it's formally and you pay them or they pay you and you're kind of working there. So I definitely agree.
Let's roll kind of into talk multifamily. We can talk short-term rental. And again, you mentioned multifamily have been hot the last several years. For people listening, I think everyone can know the stories of what's going on. You know, interest rates went up significantly over the past 2 years. You know, Basin actually just did a LinkedIn post this morning that with Fed funds rate, think it's going to be actually, is it 5.5 at the end of this year? And then over the next 2 years, getting back down into the mid threes on the funds rate, which still would keep interest rates much higher than people have been used to over the last decade, which is in the 3% range. I think they'll be somewhere in the fives or whatnot. But the switch from multifamily to kind of short term, was it based off of, explain to us kind of why you made that switch?
Yeah. So we were in multifamily again for the past few years and things were going pretty well. Interest rates were really low, but because of that, prices were really high, right? So they sort of counterbalanced each other. And yes, you know, we are used to those super low interest rates, those two, those threes, those low fours. But if you look at people who've really made most money in the space over the past 20 years, 30 years, they're used to 6-7% rates. These are nothing crazy. It was more crazy how low they were, not how high they are now. Now is kind of the long-term normal, but it's just how fast it happened that people are kind of getting blown away. But we pivoted to the short-term rental space because we saw a lot of just our yield getting sucked out of what we wanted, a mixture of cash flow and appreciation in markets that were growing at a steady rate. And when you combine those things, that's what everybody else wants as well. Mm-hmm. And when COVID happened, multifamily did very well. And that's, again, flooded the space with a lot of people who thought, oh my God, you know, multifamily is crushing it even during COVID. It's an impervious, invincible asset class. And that's not entirely true. You know, we're starting to see a little bit more of those effects of COVID money drying out now. We're kind of seeing some of those recessionary pressures in multifamily now, just a little bit later, but it really flooded the space. And I really believe that when others zig, you have to zag. If everybody's doing one thing, it's tough to make a splash in that area. So the short-term rental game, we've seen a lot of appreciation. We've been able to buy based off comparables, but sell based off cap rates. And we are projecting double-digit cash flows with that asset class. So the short-term rental space has really solved for a lot of the yield problems. And we've been able to identify a lot of operational inefficiencies and fix those and balance the portfolio for seasonality. So we were seeing really just the returns in that space versus multifamily. And like I said, I think we'll go back to multifamily. We still look at multifamily every day, but it's impossible to ignore the returns we're seeing in the short-term rental space.
Yeah, from what we've seen, and I have multifamily background experience with our primarily investing mortgage notes and not the multifamily, because like you mentioned, have a niche and everybody and their brother seemed to be getting into multifamily recently. And I think a lot of people, money was very easy to get and people were able to get loans. So that brought in more people into the multifamily space. And when DSCR ratios start to go down, LTVs start to creep up and more people getting into space, I personally believe see people with less experience get involved in the space. And you're going to start seeing, and you have seen already, some of those people already starting to feel the damage or the pain because they got adjustable rates with no caps. And the other thing with multifamily that we've seen is, you know, when your cost of borrowing is greater than the cap rate on it, it makes it very difficult to make the numbers work, of course. And because the rates went up so high, one thing with real estate that I think people miss the boat on is in today's world, we're all so focused on things happening instantaneously. Something, an event happens, a stock market goes up or down, or something happens. That's not the case with real estate. Real estate is a train trying to slow down. Like, it's slowing down well in advance, and real estate lags significantly, like 6 months to a year, and to hit some of what's going on. And on the multifamily side, and we're seeing this on the mortgage note side of things, the bid-ask spread, meaning what a seller is asking for, but compared to what is everyone else would offer, is so wide right now that in many instances, it makes it more challenging. And that's what we've seen in our space. And that's what I've heard in multifamily. Is that kind of what you, the case?
Yeah. And so I think one thing that you said that's important is real estate kind of lags, especially compared to things like the stock market. And that's one thing that really brought us into alternative assets is you can have a phenomenally robust stock portfolio and wake up tomorrow and it's gone because Elon Musk tweeted something crazy and, you know, it just pulled all the confidence out of the market. In real estate, you typically have more time to react. Yes, you might be able to project or say, hey, maybe this isn't going where we want, or hey, maybe this project or this asset is not what we hoped. You have a little bit more time to react versus things that are a little bit more volatile. So I think that was really important. And there's a big gap between what sellers want, what buyers are willing to pay, at least in my opinion, experienced buyers. Part of that is also, you know, when we pivoted to short-term rentals is because we were seeing so much less volume. I mean, over the past 2 years, we were getting maybe 20 to 25 deals in our inbox every week. There was so much volume. And now, you know, might get 3 or 4 deals a week in our inbox. I mean, if people don't have to sell right now, a lot of times they're pulling those and they know historically rates will drop after they raise. So if you can hold for the next couple of years, you'll probably get in a more favorable environment to sell. But yeah, we're seeing the volume drop and seeing buyers now have to account for crazy expenses on their loan side. And a lot of times these asset classes have been pushed quite a bit. Those rent growth that people were seeing were not sustainable. You can't push a Class C renter 10% in rents 3 years in a row. You know, you just can't do that. So that Class C renter, where a lot of people were buying that, you know, Class C property in the Class B neighborhood, they push and push and push. And now they're starting to see that tenant pool kind of push back a little bit. And now they're getting a little bit more wary, which they should. And that's healthy for the market and healthy for that tenant base. But they're getting a little bit of pushback from tenants now, especially in those lower income and income housing areas. And so that's kind of pulling yield out as well. So yeah, we're seeing less volume. And I think buyers are seeing signs that, hey, we can't keep up the growth that was seen the past couple of years. So we're getting a little bit less aggressive on what we project as well.
On the short-term side, are you investing in specific markets, areas, types of short-term rental? I know there's mountain cabins, beachfront, or just city living type. Yeah. So I was curious what you're investing in.
Yeah. So it's a fund across 10 states. Now, one of the biggest downsides of short-term rental investments, if you and a couple of buddies are going to buy a house and put furniture in it and put a lockbox on it and be short-term rental owners, is every market has those seasonalities. So with the fund being in 10 states, we really are able to balance that seasonality. So like you said, there's the party states, right? Scottsdale is a really big one for us. A lot of places in Florida, here in Branson, Missouri, which is another vacation town, Rocky Mountains, up in mountain areas, and then business travelers as well up in Chicago. And so we have this really big balance of seasonality and also tenant type, while maintaining an average daily rate of just under about $500 a night. So we hit this balance between what makes it affordable for the traveler in relation to a hotel? Because a lot of times our average party size is about 6. So to get 6 people in a hotel, that's not as economical as getting one entire Airbnb, and you're willing to pay, you know, $400 a night divided among 6 people or more. So it's balanced a lot for that and really solve that big problem of, hey, how do we avoid seasonality in our returns, both from a perspective of geography and who will actually be staying here?
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. We wanted to take a moment and tell you more about our passive income fund at 7E, which is open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. Our latest offering targets an 8% annual return distributed monthly with the ability to potentially achieve a greater return through our bonus share program. If you'd like more information,
reach out to us at invest@70investments.com to learn more. Thank you.
How has the short-term rental market been reacting over the last 6 months? I know, I'm sure during post-COVID, I have heard it's gotten the big booms. Short-term rental is not something that we have invested in. I'll be frank, it seems like a lot of work for me. And I laugh because we earn mortgage notes. My personal portfolio has some rentals, and we looked at one time putting one as a short-term rental, and then I realized how much work was involved. I'm like, nah.
It's doing extremely well. So on the operations side, one of the operating partners is actually one of the founders of AirDNA. We have access to all the data, all the searches. And throughout being able to optimize those listings and that marketing, our properties are seeing 71% more occupancy than the average properties in the markets that they share, with 41% more revenue. So there's this way that you can stand out in that market, because most people, just like you, were thinking about, hey, we have some rentals, let's turn one into a short-term rental. There's this enormous space for this institutional size operation in that space. Most of the operators now are mom and pops. And so what we've been able to do is really build out this enormous team that can handle all that effort, that work, and vertically integrate it throughout management, throughout marketing, throughout acquisitions. And yes, it's a ton of work, but that's why when you're a passive investor, it almost doesn't matter, right? If you're seeing the return that you want to see, the operations team, as long as you're running lean and have somebody that can manage it, it doesn't matter as much to you. So yes, it's a lot more work, but the opportunity in this space is so great because we're really competing with mom and pop listings almost exclusively.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about your fund, because you mentioned, you know, short-term. I think you mentioned also kind of a funds of funds model you're looking at as well. Well, first, is it a 506C?
Yes, it's a 506C, so accredited investors.
I just want to make sure, because it's 506B. I know you got to be careful on.
Yeah, we got to edit the whole podcast, man. Yeah. It is. And so we typically do have offerings for both. So this one just so happens to be 506C. So if you're not quite accredited, you know, it's still worth reaching out and getting a hold of us, because we don't typically do 506Cs exclusively. But for a fund model, it's a little bit tougher to do that. So the fund is 506C. And then what we typically do as well is the fund of funds model, like you had mentioned. So we do own and operate our existing multifamily syndications that we have here throughout the Midwest. But what we really like is more diversity. So what doing a fund of fund allows us to do is, Chris, if you have a multifamily opportunity somewhere that we don't have footprint, let's say the Carolinas, and we want to diversify in that area. Well, it's extremely hard for us to go in and be the experts in North Carolina. Know the market. We don't know the area. We don't know the, hey, how do we brand things? How do we make this better here? But you and your team might. So you'll say, hey, we're raising $10 million. And our group will come in and say, hey, Chris, if we raise $1 million for you, can our raise get preferred returns, get a little bit better returns than maybe the retail investor who invests $50,000 directly with you? Because we're bringing one big check, right? We're almost bringing like 10% of the whole raise. So it allows a couple of things. It allows our investors to get access to more preferred returns because they're now able to be part of one large check and leverage that. And it also allows for us to put our investors into highly diverse operators, whether it's cross geographies, cross asset classes. There's a lot of other asset classes that are interesting to us, but we just don't have the capacity or the desire to go in there and be experts in that field. So it allows for a lot more movement while leveraging other people's expertise in those asset classes or in those geographies.
Popped in my head, and this is me being just curious, doing a funds model. I'm sure you probably do see a lot of deals, and curious how many deals actually, I'd say, or what percent come to fruition. For example, the mortgage note fund, we've had people reach out for, I'll say, I'll use the term business purpose loans, or buy like business purpose loans that are, it's single family is owned by an LLC, but they've got certain terms to them. But then when we look at them, they're like 97% LTV percent interest, and they want us to pay full balance of the loan. And we just laugh at them. So I'm just curious if it's when you have people approach you, you know, your due diligence process, and, you know, what percent actually come across as being, you know, legit.
Yeah. So this year is actually the first year we're doing the funds of funds model. I haven't dove into that yet. So the short-term rentals is the first really big one that we're doing. So again, we're not experts in the short-term rental space, but we partner with people who are some of the biggest operators in the space nationwide. So what we do is we are vetting operators. And then again, we vet the deals as if they're our own deals. Mm-hmm. And another benefit to the fund of funds model is you almost have that double layer of vetting, right? So, you know, like I said, Chris, if you have a multifamily deal and we trust you and your team, that's one layer of vetting that we really believe that you have done a good amount of due diligence on this and it's a property mm-hmm. you believe in. And then we come in and we vet it again. As if it's brand new, we get entirely raw financials, we get everything brand new, and then we vet again. So on one hand, there's the operator. That's again going to be the number one. Just like I tell most passive investors, the operator is the number one where you should really be focusing a lot of your due diligence on. And then we underwrite the deal itself exclusively again. And when we have questions, we ask them, just as if we're a passive investor too. Hey, what's the business plan? Why did you underwrite this expense ratio? Why is rent growth projected this? Or what's CoStar say about this? You know, do you have those reports on you? So we are really running them through the ringer because we are bringing significant checks to these deals. And we want to make sure that our investors are, have confidence that, yes, we've signed off on the deal, but also you and your team have as well. So they have two really solid operators who have essentially put the green light on this asset.
Yeah. One thing that popped in my head previously, I told somebody, and you hit the nail on the head regarding the operator versus a deal. I use the analogy of, you know, a pilot and flying a plane. I'd much rather have a very experienced pilot flying plane they're comfortable flying, but might not look like it's the sexiest deal mm-hmm. compared to a brand new airplane with a pilot who has very little experience. The moment you hit a storm, that could get be catastrophic. And yeah. I think we've actually started to see some of that in the multifamily space. And I've been around in real estate since the late 90s to age myself. So I've seen what happened early 2000s with some of the office and how that got boomed and then kind of went down. And then, of course, 2008 to 12. And, you know, since that time, real estate's been a very good business to be in. And I think a lot of sins were being hidden by the amount of money the Fed was printing and, you know, the deal flow is coming out there. And now that things have changed or the weather has changed, unfortunately, some operators who might not be as experienced as people may have thought or just didn't have the experience, even if it potentially was a good deal, are getting exposed because they don't know how to manage it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think a really big factor of that progression is a lot of these courses, right, who pumped out a lot of syndicators or a lot of fund managers. And I went through formal courses myself, so I'm definitely not knocking that. But so much of that course is about acquisitions. That's all it's about. How to find good deals, how to underwrite deals, how to underwrite 100 deals a week. Once you get all the cells in this sheet to turn green, make this offer and make this happen. But once you acquire that deal, what do you do with the asset? Oh, you give it to a property manager, they do everything for you. Well, that's not really the case. That is the biggest flaw in real estate investor thinking. And I think part of that is a lot of social media and people glorifying the space. I buy a property, the manager does everything, I collect money every month. If you run it that way, you're leaving so much money on the table. And if you're taking on investor money and you do that, that's, I mean, criminal. You can't do that. So there's no property manager out there that you can just outsource to, let the hands off the reins, say, okay, they've got it taken care of, we're done. You have to manage your asset. And before, because deals were flowing so easily and cash was so accessible, acquisition specialists were like the unicorns. If you could acquire deals and get good deals, that was invaluable because money was free. Anybody could raise money over the past couple of years. Now, this is the age of the asset management team. This asset manager, which was the least sexy position in the past, because it's like everybody wants to raise big money and bring big deals. This asset manager now is emerging, and that is the most important person on the team now because things are getting a little bit shaky. And that's the person who has the most control over how your investment's going to perform.
And just for people who aren't as familiar, you know, my background, I work for some multifamily operators, and even they ran everything in-house. You always have an asset management team and a property management team. The property management, yes, they're the day-to-day people on the property trying to get things, but an asset manager still needs to walk the property to A, make sure they understand what is being done. Is there room for improvement on different things? And then get the pulse of what's going on with the building. Do you need to upgrade some more units and then understand? And like you said, when you're running these models, people are like, oh, I'll just run the model. I'm going to rent by 10%. They've never done any market study or market analysis. And oh, we're going to go in and we can turn units in 2 weeks or get these updated. And then it's like, okay, but what if it takes 6 weeks? What's that do with your absorption rate? And it takes, instead of a month to get these rented, it takes 2 months to get them rented. And what if your occupancy goes from 93% down to 89%? And all of a sudden you ask these questions and people look at you like they have six heads. But also what I've seen, and you, I think, touched upon it a little, is people force the numbers to get the deal to work. And a lot of those assumptions are the best case scenario. which probably only happened 5 or 10% of the time, instead of being realistic on understanding what happens in a sensitivity analysis to see if one of something else does happen, how am I impacted by that?
Yeah. And I think because the best case scenarios were happening. Yeah. They're happening over and over and over again. So people are like, man, 15% rent bumps. Okay, well, if I project 10% next year, that's pretty conservative. I mean, that's 33% less than what actually happened. So they were seeing that happen and they were thinking historical performance is going to dictate future performance. But again, we found that those kind of got pulled back. And again, a lot of those models that all the cells are lighting up green change a couple of those figures. And now you've got some red ones or you've got some ones highlighting yellow because now they're just really not working out, at least not the way that they expected. So, you know, cap rates are coming up. And again, a lot of it is, I don't know if many people expected rates to increase this much, this quickly. So I'm not saying that you needed to be able to see into the future to be a good operator. I think most people expected rates to increase, just not this fast. But are you prepared for those things? What happens if rates increase? Are you going to start breaking even? Are you going to start to lose money? If you start to lose money, you know, how long can you float that before the property is in real trouble? So yes, really that sensitivity analysis, I think is something that was missed a lot. And when we're vetting deals again, we're looking all the way on all spectrums of that sensitivity analysis. What does doomsday look like for this property?
I tell people, take the 2+ years of COVID and just throw all that data away. It's not an accurate representation of how a normal economy actually works. And the example of that is a forum that I was on. Somebody made a comment that they're buying a $110,000 house and that they modeled it with 10% appreciation every year. First off, I said, how'd you get that number? Well, that's what's been appreciating. I'm like, well, $100,000 house in today's world where, you know, the median's 400,000 is not going to appreciate 10% per year. If you're getting 2 or 3% on a house like that, you're probably actually fortunate, but 10 is a little lofty. And he's trying to tell me I'm wrong and stuff. And I'm like, okay, so you're telling me in like 5 years, it's going to be 6 years, this house is going to be $200,000, where 20 years ago, it was only 70,000.
Yeah. I mean, those growth and do you need the market to take you there? How much do you need that mark? Because that, if appreciates 10%, I mean, maybe because you think if it's a $100,000 home, okay, 100 to 110, is that an enormous jump? You know, probably not one time to do, but if you need that to happen, you're going to be in real big trouble. You're essentially just putting your hands together and praying and saying, oh my God, I hope the Fed does this, or I hope a new factory opens up real close to my house, or something comes in to really push appreciation.
Yeah.
And that's not planning. That's just hoping. And for me, if I'm an investor, I'm not putting my money in a hope.
That's gambling to me, but many.
Yeah, you might win. And you know, best of luck to that person. But yeah, it's when you're making investments, that's not what you want to look at. I want to look at what are the controllable things that you have.
As we wrap up this episode, last question I'll ask is, do you have any, I'll say, unique or crazy story that you could share with anybody? So most people have been in real estate long enough, have a unique one, whether it's somebody who rented a short-term rental or a tenant or whatever.
So I'll tell you the story. And it was actually with the first properties that we bought. We JV'd it. We didn't syndicate our first property. And we knew it wasn't in a great neighborhood, but the price was really good. And we didn't feel totally unsafe there. So we walk in the property and we knock on the door of one tenant. And the last ownership had completely let their hands off the reins. I mean, they hadn't been in the property in months, maybe years. They had no idea what was going on. Leases were actually fake. Their leases were just the templates. So you have a lease template that says, I, tenant name in big bold letters, agree to whatever. It would still say tenant name in the lease. Like they didn't even replace it. So we're like, okay, great deal. But again, the price was right. So we go in and we knock on a door and nobody opens. I said somebody live here because it was almost a fully vacant building. And she said, yeah, somebody should be living here. So we knock on the door and then, okay, well, just open it up. We gave notice. So we open it up and I can't describe to you the smell that immediately had hit everybody. And we all just kind of looked at each other. And, you know, I was in the military before. I'm not immune, unfamiliar with just awful smells and really things that hit the senses weird. And we all kind of looked at each other and I thought, oh my God, I bet you somebody's maybe dead in here. I mean, very possible. And the smell was so horrendous. You could almost see the air, right? Out of the building. And we start walking.
Scooby-Doo episode.
Yeah. And I'm looking around and there's people's stuff is there. And I said, okay, so somebody does live here. Now, where is that smell? We beeline it to the bedroom. There's nobody there. So there's nobody home. Okay, great. Good news for us. And we open the bathroom and somebody goes, here's where the smell is coming from. And I poke my head in and the toilet is 100% filled to the brim and overflowing with what you put in toilets. almost as if you would use the bathroom for months and months and have never flushed the toilet, right? Just let it build up, pouring over the ground and everything. And then we call the tenant and say, hey, what's going on with your property? Why is the toilet overflowing? And she goes, oh yeah, I clogged it and I've been forgetting to tell you guys. So I've just been using it. And then, you know, when you're around, can you please unclog it? So that to me and this was the very first property we had ever bought. This was like maybe the third unit I had ever walked into. And so I thought, man, this real estate investing is going to be quite a wild journey. And that was a little bit extreme, but you never know what you're going to find in these properties when people walk in or how people live. So that to me has been the most standout story that I've had, especially because it was so early on in my investing career.
We have similar where we owned a loan on a house and significant equity in the property and the borrower stopped paying and we couldn't figure out why and found out eventually after a very long, tedious process that there's a same thing. Something got backed up. So, and it was basically backed up and it was backing up in the basement. So the guy basically did nothing, never called Roto-Rooter, to the point of there was like 4 feet of water in the basement. And he basically just left the house and left all his stuff there. It was still having the cats live in the house, mold everywhere. And the guy moved next door and he was renting the house next door. Kind of sitting there like, you never thought to like sit there and just call somebody to come like scope the line or anything or so forth?
Yeah, you never know how people live. I mean, there's a lot of walks of life out there. And when you get into this business, you got to be ready to serve different walks of life and you'll see stuff like that.
Yes. Not everybody lives the way you think you live, of my advice to people. So
yeah.
Justin, thanks for coming on today. How can people reach out to you for more information about what you do or your fund? What's the best way for them to contact you?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the best ways to get a hold of me, if you love podcasting, you love passive investing, we have a show, it's called Passive Real Estate Strategies, all about funds, syndications, REITs, due diligence, everything from a passive investor's perspective. If you want to learn more about LPing, passive investments, I have an ebook called The Definitive Guide to Passive Real Estate Strategies. I would download that at thedefinitiveguidebook.com. And then once you do that, I'll send you an email, a personalized email from me with a video in it. And I'll have all my contact info at the bottom. Love to talk about our fund. Love to talk about your journey and that you have for me. But those are going to be the to get my info at.
Great. And all of that info will, of course, be in the show notes. So Justin, again, thanks for coming on today and enjoy your weekend.
Thank you so much, man. It's been awesome.
And for everybody listening, thanks for listening today. And as always, go out and leave us a review and favorite us on your favorite listening station. So thank you all.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.